The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Good morning. Everybody wide awake? How come everybody laughs at that? Well, we're still going to have more folks coming in, but welcome. Thank you all for being here. I am Keith McCurdy, and I'm excited to spend a little time with you all here. I have to tell you, I was going to say, you know, this is the most exciting part of my summer, but that would be a lie, although it's probably up there, because in about a 10-week, in a 10-day span, 3 weeks ago, my son graduated from a Christian classical school. My daughter graduated from college and took a job. My wife and I celebrated our 25th anniversary. So this is at least fourth. So we have to be honest about that. I'll give you a quick background. I have been connected to the Christian classical world for about 15, 16 years. Two children that have gone through Christian classical school, graduated. I've served on the board of a Christian classical school for 8 years, was board chair for six. Coached for 11 or 12 years in a Christian classical school, so I've had a lot of points of contact with the Christian classical world, and it's awesome, just awesome. But especially for my children and the experience they have had and the impact it's had on their life, and then of course on the life, on my wife and our lives, you know, thank you all for what you do. It is not missed by folks who have children in your schools, even though we don't always tell you that. So I wanted to start today with a story. I tell a lot of stories. And we have a 45-minute window. It's kind of a hard window because the schedule today is a little tighter than it has been during the week. And instead of filling 45 minutes with me talking, I want to try to hit 30, 35 to give 10 or 15 minutes of question and answer. So we're going to back it up to more of a 10,000-foot view than a 5,000-foot view, some of the things we're going to talk about today. But I want to tell you about a fellow I met 20-some years ago. His name is John. John came to see me. Oh, and I also run a mental health clinic. I've been in the mental health field for 31 years. Forgot that part. So John came to see me. He was in his 70s, late 70s, and he had some depression and some issues going on in his life, and he came in for some help. And through the time in getting to know him, we would reflect on things in culture. Now, this is 20-some years ago. And John told me a story. He said, you know, he said, it reminds me of when I was a little kid. I would spend spring and summer sometimes with my grandparents in far southwest Virginia in the middle of, as he called it, nowhere, corn and wheat land. And he remembered a time when he was 10 years old and he got up early before the sun was up with his grandfather and they were going to start tilling a field. He didn't know why. He didn't know if they were planting. He just remembered they were going to plow up a field. So get this picture. This is probably the 30s. They went out, they hooked up the plowshare to the mule or whatever it was and started plowing. Before sunrise, something on the plowshare broke. So he said, well, we unhooked the mule, the donkey, whatever it was, probably mule. We got the horses out, hitched them up to the wagon, put the plowshare in the wagon, and rode an hour, hour and a half on a dirt road to town, to the blacksmith. So they get to town, they go in the blacksmith shop, and he said, all I remembered was a lot of loud banging and a lot of sparks flying. The blacksmith was repairing the plowshare. He said they spent, you know, a couple hours in town. They got finished, they loaded the plowshare back in the wagon, they rode another hour and a half, now with the fixed plowshare, back to the farm, put the horses out in the field, put the wagon away, hitched up the mule, and plowed through until darkness. He said his grandfather was very happy because it was a full moon, so they could still see. So Grandma had kept dinner waiting for them, and they came in the middle of the night at some point, and they're sitting there at the table, and Grandma says, well, fellas, how was your day? Think about that. How was your day? He said his grandfather looked at him and said, it was a pretty good day, wasn't it, boy? Our day, how we viewed it, the quality of our day, used to be determined not by what occurred in it, but our ability to respond to it. We did not live in a victim state. We saw life as full of opportunity, but we knew very well the world was broken. And it was okay with us if it was broken. We just knew we had the opportunity to respond to it. Today, we can't find our keys, and what happens? We lose it. How many of you have lost your keys? How many of you did not panic and blame everybody else in your house, especially the children, for moving them, right? My son really likes it when I lose something and then I find it and he's like, see, it wasn't me. I'm like, I know it was you. But that's what's changed. If you think about it, life used to be hard but simple. Life today is easy in many ways, yet very complex. I was giving a conference probably 15 years ago, 20 years ago, giving a talk at a conference, and we talked about this, and someone said, yeah, we're full of helicopter parents. And I said, no, we have long parked the helicopters, and we are now in the snowplows. We are clearing every obstacle out of the way of our children because we have determined that hard means bad. And that's what we have to understand the community of both parents and children that you all are dealing with today. Think about the world of the children. You know, if you think a snapshot of where we are, and I hate these statistics, but they're real. 1 in 5 children are diagnosed with a major mental health disorder today. 1 in 5. 1986, 1 in 400 were on psychiatric meds. Today, 1 in 8. I mean, think about that. It used to be one in an entire class of a large high school. Now you have 2 or 3 in a classroom that have a diagnosis and are on medication. It's unbelievable. This statistic I shared yesterday with a small group, and it's the most shocking. If we look at psychiatric medications of those under the age of 18 right now in the United States, we're getting right to 8 million. The number of children under the age of 6 on psychiatric meds, we're getting right at 1 million. The number of children under the age of 1 before they can effectively communicate anything about themselves. Under the age of 1 in the United States right now, there's right at 275,000. 275,000 children under the age of 1 on psychiatric meds, and every day we have another article about how we can better diagnose depression and anxiety in infants. That's the world. That's the loudest voice about what's appropriate, healthy, and parenting in children today. Isn't that amazing? It's truly unbelievable. And so you might think, well, how in the world did we get here? Well, this is where I get to pick on my profession a little bit. You know, the field of psychology is a very interesting one if you think about the foundations of psychology. Psychology is not a new idea. In many of the classics that we read, we see psychological concepts, do we not? We see personality. We see psychological issues. The difference is, at the turn of the last century with Sigmund Freud, anybody ever heard of Sigmund Freud? What do we know of Sigmund Freud? Psychoanalysis. The turn of the last century, Sigmund Freud pretty much introduced the world to psychoanalysis. And a lot of people today will say, we really don't listen to Freud. We really are not influenced by Sigmund Freud. I will suggest to you that Freud and two key components of what he brought us are still alive and well in the world of psychology, and even more so in the world of parents about how they parent today. The two key components that Freud brought us that we have to realize are still around. Number one, if you have a problem, where did it come from? Your parents, specifically which parent? Mother. God, isn't that horrible? People say, well, we don't deal with that today. Yeah, we do. It's called mom guilt. How many moms in here have felt guilty when they raise their children that they're not doing the best job they can? Raise your hands. Right. Now, the funny part is, dads, how many of you feel guilty about that? Right? Thank you, Sigmund Freud. But in essence, really, what that told us, Sigmund Freud taught us, that truth is no longer in something transcendent. There is no longer an objective transcendent truth. Truth is now subjective within every individual. And that's how he developed psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis is the journey into yourself and into your history and into your past to find a past conflict that is causing everything that you're struggling with today. It is interesting to note, how many patients did Sigmund Freud have? Anybody know? Father of modern psychology. All we know is he had a handful of middle-aged Viennese women, one child, we refer to as little Hans, and himself. He also had a cocaine habit. I mean, all kinds of crazy things. This is the father of modern psychology. So the first thing he did is he gave us this belief system that we still hold today, that truth is no longer transcendent. Truth is no longer objective, it is subjective. I spoke recently at a college with administrators and faculty, and I made that statement, and someone sitting right where you are went, huh, to that comment. And I looked at him and I said, and you're offensive because I'm offended. And he thought, and then he laughed. He realized, oh, that's horrible. That's subjective truth. Truth is now within the individual. The second thing that Freud convinced the world of, and we see it today, and this is greatly eroded parenting, is the idea that not only is truth now subjective within every individual, it takes a professional to help you get to it. Sigmund Freud was the best marketing agent ever of the fields of psychiatry and psychology. Now, even though the field developed both in support and in reaction, Freud, and I'm not going to walk you through that complete history today because we're time limited, we never have kicked those two points. They still exist today, that the psychology community would push to you that truth is subjective and that it takes a professional to get you there. And the driving force today in psychology, just show you, so you know, we'll skip the history, the two things that drive most of parenting today, that attack healthy parenting, is the world of behaviorism and the world of humanism in psychology. Very simply, behaviorism, and you see this when they come into my office, because they come into my office and they say, I need to know a gimmick. I need to know what strategy. I need to know what token system I can use to get my child to either stop doing this or start doing that. How many of you have used token systems in your home? Charts, checklists. How long did they last? Why are you laughing? See, the question I should ask is, how many different token systems have you used in your home, right? You know, the problem with behaviorism at its core is we cannot control completely behavior. We are not. It would require us to be animals without free will. If you've been a parent, you know the only time you can control a child is before they crawl. It's called location. We can put them there and they cannot get away. But my goodness, once they start crawling, we are crazy. Because after that, we can't control them. We're losing idea of control at every step after that. Behaviorism breaks down, but behaviorism gives a faux confidence initially. Because you come in, you try a new system, and because it's novel, and they can like earn stuff, it works for a week and a half, 2 weeks. And then Johnny's got enough tokens to buy a Mercedes. That's what happens. I'll give you a quick story of a kid I worked with a few years ago, a school psychologist that was both a behaviorist and very humanistic. This little boy was coming in the school system, and he would walk in his classroom, and he just couldn't keep his hands to himself. Is that a problem in school today? In grammar school? So this little guy, he was probably, I don't know, 8, 9 years old, and he would come in, and he would just touch people and smack people and things. So the school psychologist decided that we're going to maneuver him out of this, but she was a humanist, so it's going to be all positive reinforcement. Big, big behavioral term. So they came up with a system that said, Johnny, everybody is Johnny, Billy, or Sally. Johnny, anytime you do this and hurt someone, offend someone, touch someone, but you correct it, apologize, you get a token. And bear with me, it gets better. And at the end of the week, you know, you get your tally of tokens. At the end of every week, you also, students in the classroom, get to cash in their tokens to go to this prize box. What happened? He cleaned it out in 3 weeks. The teacher said, this usually lasts the entire semester. But you know the funniest thing that happened? He couldn't walk in the school building without hitting somebody. He was smacking kids he didn't even know. By the time he got to his classroom, he'd already hit 4 kids. It totally blew up. The parents brought their child to me, and Johnny comes in my office, and I met with Johnny by himself because I already had the history from the parents. Johnny comes in and sits down, and I sit down, and I'm like, hey, Johnny, what's going on? And like he thought the room was bugged, he leans forward. He's like 8 or 9. He said, "They give me stuff." Our children are intelligent. They're smart. They will game any behavioral system you use. Now, that does not mean a behavioral system cannot be used for classroom management. You're a semi-closed environment, but you cannot parent, disciple, and raise a child with behaviorism. The second big movement, and these two are alive and well today, is humanism. These are the folks that come in and they just want to know, how can I help my child be happy? You all are eat up with this. When I speak to parents, I often ask them before I start the conversation, I say, I want you all to be processing a question the whole time we talk today. I'll give it to you all. How many of you in here, show me by hands, how many of you would like to have safe and successful children? Raise your hand. Sounds great. How many of you would like to have sturdy and capable children? Guess what? Those two cannot occur at the same time. They cannot occur at the same time. If you go back 100 years ago, if you go back and talk to my great-grandmother, and you said, what did you want in childhood for your child? I want them to be a good citizen. They're not going to be a juvenile delinquent. They're not going to hang out down on the corner. They're not going to be her kid, right? So we are going to drive into that child character qualities, character development, because you are not going to, a line I use with my family all the time, don't embarrass the family. You know, you have an identity. We're assimilating you to that identity. So we're instilling character qualities, and we really don't care how you feel about it. Does that sound like a great-grandmother statement? Her fear was delinquency. The target was good citizens were pounding in character qualities. I don't really mean pounding. Well, sometimes. Today, consistently, number one fear of moms of teenagers today is what? They will harm themselves or kill themselves. So we fear delinquency, we instill character qualities. We fear self-harm or suicide, we want to keep them happy. We have a guttural drive, believing that we have to keep our children happy and comfortable. Humanism is the self-esteem movement. Interesting, you know, we've had about 30 years now to study self-esteem. Guess what? They were wrong. The higher your perceived self-esteem is, the lower your regard for others becomes. Break the word down, self-esteem, pride in self. The more we focus on self, the less we see our neighbor beside us. Y'all experience that, don't you? The kids that have the highest self-esteem are also the ones often that are the most arrogant and annoying. Yeah, that's the world we live in. But those two movements in psychology currently are what drive the parenting mindset today. My profession, an interesting way to look at this, we talked about the meds. Prior to 1960, how many kids were on meds? Zero. Psychopharmacological research funded by the U.S. government was in the early 60s. We're pretty sure nobody prior to that in the childhood world was on psychiatric meds, yet we had lower levels of anxiety and depression. We have the highest levels of anxiety and depression today in our childhood population. So we've had this arc of meds, diagnosis, severity of symptoms, anxiety and depression. Guess what matches that arc beautifully from the 60s forward? The number of people in my profession. Yeah, that's shocking. You know, we don't deal with polio much anymore. Why do we not? We came up with a treatment. We applied the treatment to the actual problem, and what happened? The problem is now cured. How many treatments have we come up with in the field of psychology and mental health? Just pick a day. There's a new one every day. They come up with new terms and new ideas. We have our own language, the DSM, that we made up. I mean, it's crazy. If you don't know about the DSM, the DSM-5 is where we currently are. It is not based on research. No diagnostic code in the manuals based on research. If you read in the first few pages of the book, it actually says so. It says this is a symptom classification system. So if I talk with another professional and I say Johnny has XYZ, they already know the list of symptoms that we're drawing from, so I don't have to have a 40-minute conversation. I can have a 5-minute conversation. None of that came up from research. It all came up from consensus. folks like me, the last iteration of the DSM, the DSM-5, came out a few years ago. Right after it came out, I was in a conference in Charlotte with one of the people that sat on the panel. And he said, he confirmed, it blew away almost everybody in the room except one of my colleagues and I. Because, we know this, that nothing was based on research. It was a group of folks that got together, looked at the prevailing winds. What's going on in our world and culture that's affecting everybody? Let's categorize it with some symptoms and give it a name. We now have a disorder for kids that have a lot of tantrums. We do. All the research for the DSM is done after the fact to show you how often it happens. Once we've labeled it and given it a name, now we're going to go out and show you how often we see it. We then report that rate of incidence, and it sounds like it's research-based. So we have come up with that, and what we have done is we have convinced parents they don't know what they're doing. They absolutely don't know what they're doing. Freud, when he said truth is within the individual, he also said truth from anyone that came before you doesn't matter. He began cutting the cord. You know, we talk about permanent things. One of the permanent things we have is generational wisdom. We're called in Genesis to be generational. Freud started cutting that cord of generational wisdom. Psychology today has completed it. Think about what the fallout has been from where we have gone with this. I'll give you a handful of things to think about. It's not a complete list, but it's a handful to think about. Number one, I call the rise of the professional. You go back to my grandmother, you've got a problem with your child, who do you talk to? Her parents, other parents. You get three categories of wisdom if you go back two generations, typically, about parenting. The first is someone else in your family, someone that has walked before you. Second is a pastor, because a pastor must be educated in how God says raise your children. You know what the third was? This will make you laugh. Third seat of wisdom historically about parenting. Teachers. Yet today y'all are treated like the complaint department at the DMV. Right? You used to be a seat of wisdom. Psychology now has got us and culture has gotten us to the point that today when you have a problem with your child, who do you call? Me. My grandmother would say, if I was going to read a book on parenting by whoever, my grandmother would have said, if she was alive today, she'd say, well, do you know who wrote that book? I said, well, no. Have you met them? No. Do they even have children? She would have said, give me real information, experience, and evidence that anybody knows anything about what they're talking about, not just because they have a bunch of letters behind their name. But we have sold out. Today, parents are steered to and pursue my profession consistently because they believe, they have been convinced, it has been developed up in them through the last two generations that the people that know the most about raising your child are those in my profession. Here's the crazy thing about that. If I line up 10 professionals right here, and I give them a list of symptoms, and I say, what's wrong with Johnny? They're going to come to an agreement on two or three diagnoses. And they're all going to look at each other, nod their head, and talk about the DSM. Great. If I ask the same 10 professionals, what does a healthy child look like? They won't be able to answer it. Psychology is not based on identifying health. Psychology is based on finding dysfunction. The modern world of therapeutic psychology. Historical picture of psychology, understanding how we work, looked at everything. But the modern world of therapeutic psychology is determined to look at dysfunction. Now think about that. Would you want to take your child to someone that can't determine and has no view of what a healthy child looks like? I ask this in conferences all the time. I'm not always a good guest at a conference, a psychological conference. One of my buddies goes and he says, do not ask questions. They said ask questions. And I've said, you know, what's your model? Just because we love models. What's your model for a healthy child or a healthy family? You would think that I just blew the room up when I asked that question. But I want to know, do you have a view? Psychology does not have an underlying, agreed upon, theoretical view, position, theory. There's not a singular, agreed upon view of what healthy is. That's very troubling. But yet we have the rise of the professional. We've convinced everyone, if you have a problem with your children and your family and your marriage, you have to come see me. Second thing, that I'll give you a second one that happens. We have over-emotionalized our children. I think Abdu was talking about yesterday that we have put emotions above facts and reason. I think that's the way he put it. You know, we have elevated the importance of the emotional experience above everything in life. And let's talk about why that's flawed. I had a good friend of mine a couple years ago that got held up at gunpoint in his car at a red light in the South Bronx. Car was running. Guy walked up, ding, ding. I said, what'd you do? He goes, there was a car in front of me. I had to give him my wallet. So South Bronx, let's get the picture. It's the highest crime rate area of New York right now, has been consistently for a while, depending on the stat you look at. So you go to New York for an ACCS conference, let's say, and a couple of you decide you're going to go to a pizza joint that you heard about in the South Bronx. So you go to the South Bronx, and you go in, you have pizza, you take the subway there, walk about a block and a half to the restaurant, eat dinner, you come out, it's dark, you say, oh, excuse me one second, I need to go to the restroom. You go to the restroom, you come back, and your friends have ditched you. Has that already happened this week here? Yeah. It's like they were right here in the lobby. Come on. So they've ditched you, and you think, oh, I know where they are. They're going back to the subway station, so I'm going to go this way and cut through the alley and catch them. So you're tooling through the alley in New York City in South Bronx, and a bunch of guys come in the alley after you. How do you feel? Scared. I've had people going, I would not do that. I would, in my view, you're doing it. You're scared. Now, if you're laying at home in bed asleep and you dream the same scenario, how do you feel? Scared. You ever woken up in a fright? Now, if you're at the movie theater and there's a scary movie on the screen and something jumps and for that split second, you know, gets you, in that split second, how'd you feel? Scared. If you're in the alley in New York City in the first example, are you in danger? Yes. When you're laying in bed dreaming, are you in danger? No. When you're at the theater, can anything on that screen hurt you? Our feelings, our emotions cannot tell the difference between fantasy and reality. It is the most significant daily practical experience of brokenness that we have, that our emotional world does not consistently indicate truth. So if we have elevated emotion and emotional experience, it's like me giving my Boy Scouts, or actually my Cub Scouts, a broken compass and dropping them in the middle of the forest. That's where we are. That's what we have done. Another thing that's happened, we have gone through a couple phases of the family. We used to be in the family system that I call top-down. I'm on top, you're at the bottom. I tell you what to do, you go do it. I'm not saying it always worked well. I'm saying that was the process. And we slid through a few years back what I call the Democratic family. The Democratic family is that Johnny now gets a seat at the table. And if you've ever served on a board or been in administration or even teachers, you've heard this. Yeah, we haven't asked Johnny if he wants to come back here next year to school. He's 7. Have you asked him what your next car should be or if you're going to have another child? He's 7 years old. How many of you see that every year at re-enrollment? Yeah, we haven't asked Johnny. Or we need to ask Johnny where we're going to dinner tonight. Really? Is he paying? Because I want in on that. I like lobster. I mean, but that's the Democratic family. But we have now passed that, folks. We're now at the therapeutic family. Johnny has an elevated seat. And we've become the court jesters keeping him entertained. 30 years ago, when I would deal with teachers, the biggest complaint was still at that point in time, you know, how can I more effectively teach and things like that? The number one complaint now is, how can I get children to behave and pay attention? How can I get children to behave and pay attention? The next thing we've done is we've confused a couple words. We've confused empathy with sympathy. Sympathy is this. Sympathy is the appropriate emotional expression of understanding about tragedy, true trauma. Most majority, very small, very large percentage, never experienced something like that in childhood. We should be applying empathy to most situations. I'll give you a very simple one. Johnny comes home from school. He's 8 years old. Oh, school is horrible today. Like he just came from the logging camp, right? It's like, wait a minute. They opened the door for you. They gave you lunch. They talked about Jesus, told you to have a great evening. And it was a horrible day, right? Sympathy is this. Sympathy is, oh, I'm so sorry your day was so bad. Come in here. I'm going to run you a hot bath, and I'm going to make you macaroni and cheese, and I'm going to... That's what we have parents doing on a pretty consistent basis. Empathy is demonstrating we hear where you are. We get it. But we're not going to play into your emotional distortion. Empathy is, oh, man, you know, change the word. I'm sorry it was a tough day. You know what? Here's a snack and get on your homework. You'll be okay. I have a son who's about 6.5 feet tall. He weighs about 200, 210 pounds. He has 0% body fat. He's an endurance athlete. I use the example of a year ago, he rode, competed in a 150-mile bike race. I don't know why. He does this stuff. And literally, 2 days later, I'm going to a school to speak, and I need him to move a wood pile. It's not big. And I said, you know, David, I'm looking him in the eye as he has a beard. Looks like an Alaskan. His biceps are the size of my thigh. And I'm like, hey, man, I need you to move that wood pile while I'm gone. He's like, ugh. Dude, you rode 150 miles on a bicycle wearing tights. I'm sorry. You don't get tougher than that in my world. And you're complaining about moving like 75 pieces of wood 20 feet. And he says, well, Dad, because he is classically trained, I wanted to ride my bike 150 miles. I do not want to move this wood. Now, if I was playing the sympathetic card, I'd be like, oh, man, I know. I'm so sorry. I know moving wood is horrible. No, if I play the empathy card, I'm like, man, I know you don't want to move it. I get that. I don't want to move it. That's why I'm asking you. Honestly. But I get you don't want to move it. But when you go to sympathy, you got nothing else because you've just said this is the most horrible thing in the world. When you go to empathy, guess what? The door's still open for more conversation. I say, man, I know you don't want to move it. You'll be all right. And I leave. Guess what? He moves the wood, and what happens? He's still all right. I've just partially corrected his emotional distortion. He was thinking it was traumatic, and he just learned through experience it really wasn't that big a deal. But we have confused those two words today in parenting. Another thing we have done is we have, well, and I talked about this, we have fully severed now the value of historical generational wisdom. And I think that may be one of the most dangerous things we've done. You know, we have basically said to parents today, those who have gone before you and done it well, and we have the statistics to back that up for the mental health of children, don't know anything. It's a very progressive humanistic stance. Progressiveness in the world of psychology basically means this: because we thought of it now, it's better than what you thought of yesterday. Because we thought of it now, it's clearly more right than what you thought of yesterday. And then the humanistic part of that is, and it's all about feeling good. So when I talk to parents, what I say to them is, and we walk through this, and I say, ultimately what we have done is we have pulled the role of struggle and challenge out of the life of your child. And yet it's struggle and challenge that begins to give them perspective of life. A lot of people ask me, you know, what's your favorite verse, passage on parenting, and the one I whip out first is, if a man doesn't work, he shouldn't eat. And that really is probably number two, because it sets up really the basic learning aspect of life, which is cause and effect. But the one I give, and the one that is the sausage making of parenting, is the beginning of the book of James. I will absolutely paraphrase this. Consider it pure joy whenever you face trials, struggles of many kinds. Develops perseverance. Perseverance basically is the ability to stick with something when it's hard, difficult, you don't want to do it, it's painful. Perseverance must finish its work, based on translation, so that we are mature and complete. Maturity is our goal, not safety. Maturity requires struggle. Healthy struggle is the engine to growth and maturity in the lives of our children. Healthy struggle is the engine to growth and maturity in the life of our children. And yet our parents will blow our phones up because Johnny had to do Latin on Saturday because he didn't do it during the week. We have totally abused that idea of what maturity really is. And so when I talk to parents, very quickly, and I will not over-explain it because I want to give you all a chance to have questions. When I talk to parents, I walk through four things with them to reintroduce a correct order in the family. The first is boundaries. It's not the psychobabble turn of boundaries. It's like a fence around your house, your family. You've got to first start asking questions. What do we say yes to? What do we say no to? What are we claiming is good? What are we saying is not? We begin informing on truth, beauty, and goodness. It forces us as parents to ask, what do we gain from this? What do we lose? What is the actual nature of a sleepover, and is that a healthy thing? What is the actual nature of, and is it beneficial for my children to play in someone else's backyard that I don't know? Is it actually appropriate for them to have technological infusion in their life? Forces parents to actually take a look of who are we saying we are? This begins forming a family identity that then helps you form your children's identity. The second thing is we have to do less and require more of them. It used to be culturally that as soon as a child demonstrated a functional ability, we gave them a reason to use it. Functional abilities appear between the age of 2 and 3. As soon as Johnny could pick up sticks, he carried kindling. As soon as he could pick up logs, he carried wood. As soon as he could reach the head of the horse, he was harnessing the horse for the field. As soon as they could reach the sink, they washed dishes. That's how we used to deal with life. We took seriously in Genesis, whether we knew what we were doing or not, the ownership of life, that process happening and beginning as soon as you demonstrate functional ability. Parents today do not introduce chores. If they ever do, typically don't fight that battle till the teenage years. Well after now, very young adults have decided that's not part of my life. I get a lot of that in my office. A lot of research out there about chores, Harvard Grant study. Younger in life you have chores, the higher life satisfaction you have in retirement. It's kind of wild. Third thing is the basic learning tool of childhood is cause and effect rather than reward and consequence. It's the whole idea that God is a God of order and we put things in life in routine. You will change your grammar school if every one of your parents did this. Hey, Johnny, school's over. Great. Here's your snack, and I don't really care when you do your homework, but you can't do anything else till it's done. Dance, piano, karate, travel, baseball, nothing is sacred. That child does nothing until that homework is done. And done means it's completed, it's corrected, and the bag is repacked by the front door. Right? That's where moms are like, whew, yeah. And by third grade, your bag's repacked by the front door and you've helped prepare your lunch for the next day. Imagine how we simplify the morning. That's cause and effect. And then once Johnny does the homework and it's done by that, it's like, hey, we don't care what you do now or how long it takes, but you can't do anything else till you're a contributing member of the family. You're going to help out with something around here today. Is there not always something that needs help at your home? Yes. It's like 40 things every day at my house. And so we require that of them. Then once they've completed that appropriately, then they can go have free time within the boundaries you've set. If every parent in your grammar school did that, wow, it would transform your grammar school. Fourth thing is limit technology. We could have an all-day event talking about technology and the infusion of technology and the benefit of it or not. The analogy I give parents is this. We've let the camel's nose under the tent, and you have a decision to make. Moving forward, we either kill the camel or we begin cordoning off a large portion of our home and family and life for all the excrement the camel provides. Those are the only two places you go when we have too much and early infusion of technology right now in the lives of our children. Technology can be a resource. It gets problematic when it becomes a primary source of entertainment or filler of boredom. We've removed boredom from the lives of our children. Boredom is required for the development of two things, creativity and decision-making. It is required for creativity and decision-making. Number one complaint of HR directors of businesses I consult with is when they hire millennials, they cannot make a decision. They cannot think beyond the instructions on the sheet of paper in front of them. They've never been bored. So, we have a couple minutes. Any questions? You can ask anything. We have 5 minutes. Yes, speak loudly. Well, I'll answer that in two ways. The first is, in all the years I've done this, I can't find a healthy function for playing video games unless you're a drone pilot in the military. And And trust me, because I know what they do in the military to prepare drone pilots has nothing to do with the video games your children are playing. They really don't. Let me give you an example. It's a question I've answered several times this week already. When parents come to me and they ask, Johnny has ADHD, Johnny can't pay attention, Sally is anxious, Sally's depressed, all these things we're told, how can we figure out what to do with my child? The first thing I will tell them is this: for the next 3 months, strip all technology out of their life, including television, for 3 months. They cannot even look at the weather on your phone for 3 months. Then I pick the parent up off my office floor, but I tell them that for 3 months. Then, for 3 months, have a regular bedtime that occurs, regular means, happens at the same time every night. Again, nothing is sacred. No ballet, no karate, no travel sports. I don't care who they are. Nothing is sacred for 3 months and target 10 hours. For 3 months, feed them breakfast, lunch, and dinner reasonably healthy. For 3 months, in 30 years, when I've had parents do that, I've never had them walk back in. Now, I do a few things with them during the 3 months, but I've never, unless the child has psychosis or pervasive developmental disorder, I've never had them come back in without significant improvement in whatever area they're dealing with. The first thing I do is we have to get the pollution out of the way. I never recommend video games. My children have grown up without them. We're the odd ones. My son, when he's in fifth grade, a kid was making fun of him because he doesn't play video games, and my son said, yeah, but we shoot stuff and blow stuff up. So he was like the man after that. Cell phones, smartphones, the word need. I grew up without them, and I'm still here, so they're not a need. I recommend come up with a reasonable function. The function in our home with cell phones is driving. That actually means they didn't have one until they were 15 and a half years old. They function just fine. My kids are as social, if not more social, than a majority of their peers. I think primarily because they've had that out of their life. So does that help? Okay. One more question. Yeah. Here's what I do at schools. If I've been to your school, raise your hand in this room. Yeah, a handful. Good. Was that helpful? What I do when I come into a school is I spend a day, and I will take an hour with your middle and upper school, primarily upper school. If you twist my arm, I'll do your middle with it. And we talk about perception. We talk about what's informing their perception and the fact that they're running on emotions and a negative confirmation bias and how they can begin to not do that. And I really challenge them, do you want to be fragile or do you want to be sturdy individuals that can do hard things? It's great. It's amazing what they will tell me about their desire to not live the way they're living. Then the second conversation we have a little bit later in the day is with faculty and administration. I'll do an in-service training for an hour, hour and a half, and then we'll have 30 minutes to an hour of Q&A about everything you're dealing with in your classroom and in the school, how to deal with parents when they call because Johnny has Latin to do on Saturday. And then that evening we do a parent forum where we invite the parents in and spend an hour to an hour and 15 minutes presenting some of what you've heard, but more expanded, and then allowing them to have 30, 45 minutes of Q&A. And the goal is to give a common context and common language around the idea of we want our children to struggle with the right things because it's necessary for their development. Thank you, Peter, for asking that. That's what I do. I do a myriad of other things. If I've come to your school, what I recommend is the next year you have me come back and do, I run a full-day parent retreat where the first full half of the day is tearing apart where we are and all the things in our culture that play into how we're operating that way and how we got there. Second half of the day is actually all of the things they bring in. How do we go home and do this differently? And so then, you know, imagine if you had 50 key parents, 25 key couples in your school that now have a fully trained mindset about how to parent differently, the effect that would have on your school. So thank you. One last question. Well, we got maybe two more. Yes, sir. Well, we're doing that right now at Faith. We have a security and safety committee that I chair, and we're working through all this. We've had groups come in and, as consultants and things. You know, you're still safer in your school than you are in your car, statistically. I mean, we've got to be honest with parents statistically about the fear they're running on. But then we also have to do our due diligence to say we're doing reasonable things and reasonable steps. And there are multiple stages they look at. You know, number one, we want to mitigate anything that makes us potentially an easy target. And there are many steps consultants can give. And I do think, as a school, with where we are today, we should do that. We should look at that, get good information, get good consultants. Every school is different, and there's going to be different suggestions for every school. But I think it's something we should address. But we can't get away from the statistics, the reality, that we are still safer in a school than we are in a car. Does that help? One more. It's got to be the best one of the night or the morning. Now go ahead. Yeah, let me explain that. Behavior management theory, the idea of rewards and consequences and maneuvering behavior, it was designed primarily for inpatient psychiatric hospitals in the 40s and 50s. The number one commodity and token was cigarettes. So yes, when you're given a token in the classroom, you're giving Johnny a vape. That's what you got to think of. Now, no, I did not say that. That's not recorded. No. But what we know is, in a completely closed system, behavior management works very well. It's not complete. I mean, we know this from the Holocaust. We had folks who defied, yet they were completely controlled in a sense. But ultimately, I mean, generally, behavior management works well in a closed system. It works okay in a semi-closed system. You know, the idea, we want to maneuver children in the classroom. We want to spark certain things and motivate things. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem with that is when we take that and think we raise children with reward and consequence. Because then it's based on the child and what we want of them in that moment. It's not based on guiding principles from Scripture. So it's, and there's a vast difference. Yes, sir. Oh, here's how you get a hold of me. I'll give you an email address. It's my name, Keith McCurdy. KEITHMCCURDY, nothing capitalized, TLC, my company's Total Life Counseling. Keith McCurdy, TLC, @gmail.com. Can I say a prayer? Let's pray. Father, we thank you for this morning. I thank you for the, what a blessing it is to be among such great folks. The speakers that have come and the folks in this room, it has been a true blessing. I thank you for their passion for what they do, and I thank you ultimately for their passion for you and their love for my kids as they were educated. Thank you for this time, in Christ's name. And we ask for blessings on safe travel for everyone as we leave the conference later today. In Christ's name, amen. Thank you all.